contrary to what you heard, you are also God's child. Contrary to what Christians have been telling you, you are one of God's children. Contrary to what everybody else has been saying, your culture is beautiful. Your language is acceptable. Your dances are beautiful. Your songs are beautiful. Kept that message going, going, and going. Until in the early 1970s, there was a huge resurgence in Nativism. In the 1960s and 50s, there used to be only one Shoshone sun dance on the Crow Reservation per year. This year, it's scheduled about 5 of them, I believe. You know? Crow Fair used to have only about 25 or 28 teepees erected in the 1950s and early 60s. Now there's over 1,000 every year. The Crow Fair dance from 1959, the Crow Fair committee came and paid me $10 to dance on a Saturday night. And several of my friends came and danced with me, and there was only about 14 of us dancing on that Saturday night Crow Fair. Now we'll have over 500 contestants, over 600 in grand entry. You know, that kind of resurgence. I never even dreamed of being at a powwow in Denver, Colorado, where they would have 1,187 in grand entry in the Denver Coliseum. It was unheard of in the 1950s. It happened in 1995. I didn't think that I'd be bringing in a grand entry in Phoenix, Arizona, with 900 even dancers, 900 even in grand entry. I never even dreamt that I would be announcing the powwow in Louisville, Kentucky. It happened in 1994. And so the resurgence of Native culture is based on finding once again that there is beauty in a Native life, contrary to what we heard. There is importance in Native life, contrary to what we heard. And our Native languages are important, contrary to what we heard. How many Michael Jackson fans in here? I want to see who I'm going to offend you at first. You know, the state of Montana, as you know, has passed an English-only law. I was in Denver, Colorado, and the English-only bill had been passed by both houses, was sitting before the governor. It was on his desk, and we knew that he was going to sign it. And so I told the people, right now, you know, the state of Montana is requiring English only on all government documents and all government-sponsored events, English only. And so, and they said that Native languages could be taught as secondary languages. Well, we've already said the values to him, haven't we? One is primary, the other is secondary. Which is more important? That's the message that could be passed on to our children. And so if this takes effect like we think that it will, we don't do anything about it, Native languages are going to disappear. Once the Native languages disappear, the cultures quickly follow. The beliefs disappear, and that's the foundation of any culture, the beliefs. Once they crumble, the culture disappears. When that happens, I said to the crowd, we're going to be a bunch of brown-skinned white people. But interestingly enough, with hardly any of their economic and political privileges. Hardly any. And so, it kind of looks bleak, but there's hope. If Michael Jackson can do it, so can we. But then again, we're kind of poor, and we don't have a whole lot of money to leave the nation's poorest of the poor. We won't be able to afford much, so we'll just do the parts that show. Going to Sweat Lodge, we have brown bodies and white hands and faces. anyways, you know, the those are just some of the cultural issues that faces, and they're very important. We joke about it, but Native Americans have a very keen sense of humor. Because of, without the sense of humor that they have developed, with the kind of oppression and subjugation that we have been put under, I think that our ancestors might have lost their minds because they had to rely on something given through part of it was humor. Part of it was humor. You know, learn to laugh at yourself, learn to laugh at your situation. You know, knowing full well that this isn't going to last. You know, that I ripped my heart out before you end it all. You know, so they were committed in that way. And they became strong by being able to laugh at it. I'm now going to describe to you what I call the holistic definition of culture. And the anthropologist will describe it in a manner that is just a little different than what I do, but how I describe it, you know, gives you an indication as to four major aspects of any culture. And this is how we look at cultural survivability. The four major aspects: communication, social structure, ideology, and technology.
Whoa! Technology. I need to head out and take a sick man to Billings. Thanks very much. This is great.
Thank you.
Oh, I need to tell you, Dale didn't say it in so many words, but he's the number one powwow announcer. Now, probably not only as a pro fair, every time I get kept awake at night trying to sleep, listen to his jokes laughing every so often. He comes right through the walls of the TV.
Thanks. Yeah. I don't know if you've read the New National Geographic. June 1994 issue was quoted widely in it, and they had an article on powwows. So I was telling the people, it just came out when we were in Nashville, Tennessee, had a powwow. It was a big powwow, a lot of people watching, and everything like that. Jonathan Winterbourne and Terry Fiddler and I made it to National Geographic, International Magazine. We're kind of proud of that, but we have to put it into perspective. You see, Indian Affairs was placed under the Interior Department, and so they manage us Indians right along with the buffaloes and the rabbits and the bears and the fishes. And that's in a benevolent and wise decision of the United States government. And so Terry Fiddler, a Sioux Indian, and Jonathan Windyboy, a Chippewa Cree Indian, and Dale Warren Crow Indian made it to the National Geographic Magazine. We made it along with the apes, pansies and baboons. We thought it was cute. Okay, technology. Technology is defined to comprise of these major parts. Tools? Tools. You're using a technological phenomenon there, the pen. Then you might go use a technological phenomenon called the computer. It's a tool. Tools are two types, construction and destruction. The tool itself is innocuous. But what you use it for, you know, it's a targeting a tool. Shelter. Clothing. Clothing is kind of interesting. You know, we attach moral or ethical concepts to clothing, but clothing is predicated by the environment in which it's built. You know, like for instance, right now, right at this time, we're kind of overdressed for West Palm Beach, Malibu, overdressed for Mazatlan, you know, but somewhat underdressed for Argentina right now. You see what's going on here? And cultural and ethical and moral constructs with clothing are often born of the environment in which we find.
Technology is defined to be how humankind adapts to and adopts the environment for survival and proliferation. So what do? We eat, we consume things for sustenance. Humankind, very interesting. If it flows, we'll drink it. If it flies, crawls, walks, runs, swims, we'll eat it. If it grows, we'll eat it. Sometimes with some dire effects. There was a guy who used to advertise for post treatments. Ewell Gibbons was his name. He was a naturist. And he'd go around and pick up all kinds of different things and he'd eat them. One day he ate the wrong thing. He died. Poisoned himself. He died from eating something. But that shows you what humankind used to do. Go graze a little bit, hunt a little bit, drink a little bit, fool around with food a little bit, consume that and see what happens. So, health maintenance. Of the nations of the world's food nowadays, by the way, and I got this figure from the United States Department of Agriculture, 60% of the world's food came from, guess who? American Indians. Isn't that amazing? Over 80% of all known pharmacology that has to do with battling bacteria came from who? American Indians. Isn't that amazing? Yeah. Clothing, shelter, and tools. All of these comprise the technology of the future. Communication, there's oral, physical, and written communication. And physical. It's interesting because physical communication takes on some sophisticated ways of communicating, like the international sign that is done now, and also the Northern Plains Indians. We still have sign language. We still use it today. And it's interesting, down the Kiowas, you know, used to be Northern Plains people who were moved down there with the Removal Act of 1830 or 31, still carry on this sign language. You know, and I was teasing those boys down there. You know, it's been stylized a little bit, it's somewhat changed because cultures do change, cultures do evolve. If we don't change or evolve, we don't, then we're a dead culture. So if we remove our dynamism, then we're dead. See? And so I went down there and I said, you know, up there in the North Country, my Kiowa brothers here, I just want to let you know that we still go like this for yes. And you boys down here going like this to me. Outstanding or a great magnitude, we still go like this, and you boys go like that to me. And this is good. You kind of put a twist at the end of it, like that. Nowadays, this is nothing or gone. You guys go like this to me. You've got a different twist to the signing that we're doing. And I asked these Kiowa boys, excuse me, why is there a difference between the Northern Sign Language and the Southern Sign Language? And they told me it was the Oklahoma drawl. Okay. Physical language, posturing, facial expressions, gesturing, things like this. Those are all culturally driven. And all of these we learn from each other. We learn language from each other, we learn writing from each other, we learn physical language from each other. Social structures include such things as the manner of education, military, such things as kinship, and such things as its governance, such things as recreation, entertainment, social and fraternal organizations, and so forth. You know, and this is only limited by the imagination and the creativeness of the culture that they're found in. Ideology is comprised of two major areas, thought and philosophy. Under philosophy, we cite defined beliefs, belief systems, morality, and a sense of religiosity. Do you know what I mean by religiosity? Yes. See, some of us believe that other people, even though we say we're all created as children of God, some of us think that some people are closer to God than others. You know? We believe that. You know, it's in human archetype. It's, hey, this guy's a medicine man. This guy's, gosh, this guy can have, you know, he has the hidden power. As a matter of fact, we'll put our, you know, human beings will put it either. Huh?
There's two.
I don't know. I think he might be at Jeff's. Yeah.
Okay. He has a truck, huh?
Yeah.
My dad needs a pickup.
Does he?
Yeah.
Yeah. We'll truck at Jeff's. He doesn't know. No.
All right.
Yeah. Or we'll put our hands on a radio and wait for that human to come through it, you know? Or we'll contribute $8 million because, you know, God's going to take the man away or something like that. This is such a religiosity. Thought, values, ethics, aesthetics, and psyche over here. You know, under psyche we have emotionality, intellectualism, knowledgeability, and so forth, memory, all these happening within the psyche. And then we draw this circle, a little quadrant, and draw these arrows to indicate that all aspects of the culture are, in fact, interactive. You know, just this lecture alone illustrates it. I use gesturing, I use sign language, I'm using posturing, I'm using an oral language, I'm using a written language to communicate to you about knowledge that has to do with a comparison. And remember a while ago I did the morality thing, value thing. Another aspect of it, you know, is hitting on the edges of it, you know, what aesthetics, you know, what looks good, what sounds good, you know, what is acceptable kind of thing. So all of these, I'm using a tool to communicate with you inside of a shelter, and we're all wearing clothes, obviously, and reasonably healthy. And so that indicates to you how interactive culture is. Very important that they all are interactive. You see, today they wanted me to talk to you a little bit about kinship. Kinship is very complicated for the Crow-Indian. Our sense of affiliation and belonging and identity comes as first. You can look at it in terms of not hierarchical structure, but in terms of how we look at each other from the whole as members of this great nation we call the Psaloga, the children of the large beak bird, a spiritual bird that has no physical counterpart, which is an interesting thing. You know, the spiritual aspects or the knowledge of the spiritual realm, often defined by the Christians, you know, takes an anthropomorphic nature at all times. God is a man. We are created in the image of God, right? Isn't that what the Bible says? So what does God look like? Look like a man or a woman? Is he dark or light? Black, dark brown, yellow, pink, what is he?
But the native says that God is a being greater than our understandings. So they don't even attempt to put an anthropomorphic definition of God. And so the social structures that were instituted by the Crow Indians, you know, all have this idea, this belief statement, that this knowledge came from God. You see, not only are we creatures of God, knowledge, words, and thought, mind, comes from God. And we just kind of use it. We're crows, then we belong to a band of the crows. And there are four major bands. One of which is lost to us. They're the mountain crows, the river crow, the kicked in the millies, I'm just going to shorten these out, and then the beaver dries its fur. This one is lost to us. We don't know what happened to them. Either all completely killed off, died off, or joined another nation. We just don't know.
Which one?
Beaver dries its fur. The mountain crows are the people that predominantly live in the Crow Agency, St. Xavier, and Pryor. River crows are those of us who live in Crow Agency and north, across to Two Leggins and north. Kitkinabilis are those people that primarily live in Lodgegrass Creek and Loyola. And so that's the configuration. You know, I'm a Black Lodge, and it's Patchwalocal, which means that we belong to the band of our father. And in the case of females, they join the band of their husband. They may marry within their own bands, and just because it's a political affiliation and not blood or social kinship. And then in addition to that, some of us have affiliation with each other through the warrior societies, of which there were four. The Lumpwoods, the Foxes, the Muddy Hands, and the Big Dogs. There was a fifth one, which was a volunteer organization, those were the Crazy Dogs, who committed themselves to death much like a sacrifice in battle. Rear guard action, they provided it. If they needed to attack a group singly to draw fire to themselves, they did it. And they were very brave individuals who welcomed death, they said. We're poor on this land. You know, the other side camp, everyone is doing well. Yeah. And you know, they welcome the Crazy Dogs. And then, in addition to this, we have religious affiliations. Religious affiliations that are very important to us. The reason why we crows live here is because of the sacred tobacco seeds, Ichichia. It is named Ichichia, I believe, is a name which means white unto itself, because the flower of the plant is white and looks like a little star within a green leaf. And that religious organization itself is very important to us, and there are religious orders within that religion. The orders such as the weasels, the otters, the beavers, elks, the birds, the eagles, the meadowlarks, the ducks, so on and so forth. And I understand that at one time there were about 22 functional religious orders within that religion. But now, with the demise of the crow, you know, much of it has been lost. Some of them died off. They couldn't pass it on. The crows, we have 10 clans. Various people talk about 13 clans, they talk about 15 clans, but in all of my research, I've been only able to find 10 clans, and some of these clans have more than one name, hence adding to the confusion. The 10 clans were named by Old Man Coyote, who was a personage that could come and he would appear as a man, appear as a coyote, appeared as a bird, appeared as many things. Appeared as an animal, he had a counterpart who we call Shudabet, which in the archaic language is believed to mean red fox. One was a coyote, the other was a fox. And they would, you know, change shape as they were around, and they instructed the crows on many things. And one of the instructions that we received from these spirit beings was the clans. There's the greasy mouth, greasy inside the mouth. There's the sorlets. The one which was originally known as the wealthy gophers, whose name was changed to Whistling Water, and I'm of that clan. There's the hairy mating lodges, whose name was later changed to Bad Wardies, because one of them lied about a Wardie, and they chided him, and then they finally gave the entire name to this entire clan as Bad Wardie. There's the ties in the bundle. And they kept their original name. And then there's the bring home game without shooting clan. Then there's the crop-eared domesticated animals. And their name was later changed to dung eaters because one of their, a man that was, who had achieved the position of a leader amongst the tribe as a chief, committed some things that were totally unacceptable for the Crow people. That was to be jealous of your mate, to be possessive of your mate, to abuse your mate. That was totally unacceptable. And he became jealous of his wife. I understand that she was very beautiful. He cut her hair, beat her, and made her eat dung. And so her brothers got very angry, took her back, and this man was ostracized by the entire nation. In other words, I don't know of any greater punishment than to be ostracized by your people. You're not allowed to be a part of anything anymore. And then they, instead of calling his wife the dung eater, they called him the dung eater. And then this name spread to his clan. And so they crop-eared domesticated animals became known as the dung eaters. And then there's the big lodges. Before we get to the big lodges, there's the treacherous lodge, and whose name was later changed to Big Ann Clan. And this was a compilation of errors. See, we call them Ashkanna because the Bad Wardeeds said that the treacherous lodge is so treacherous they are like our enemy, the Kanna, which is an attempt to say Kaina, which is the name that the Bloods use for themselves, which means all chiefs. Okay, we're jumping through different languages now, okay? The Kaina are members of the Blackfoot Confederacy or the Blackfoot Nation, and they are one of the three bands. Kainai, meaning all chiefs, Siksika, meaning Blackfoot, and then the Pikani, which means hair remaining robes, badly translated to scabby robe, and the white people are trying to say Pikani, you know, they didn't say it right, they said Pigan. And so the Crows, you know, made it, coupled that mistake by calling the Kainai, using the Crow phonology, Kamna, translated it to Pigan. So hence we have the Pigan clan. Then the big lodges, and then the 10th clan, newly created lodge. You know, as we went through this, I named off 13 different names. Hence, you know, three have second names. And then there's others that have nicknames, Akhaji Ghbari, for the greasy mouth. Those who use the sun as their medicine. Okay. Then the Whistling Waters, because of their original name, wealthy gophers, call each other Gopher Boy. See, Gopher Boy, Chikashigaga, which is another nickname. That would explain the 15 different clans. And if they heard of these other nicknames,
that I'm going to use. No, I guess those are just names that, or identifications that we use for each other, and they have not made it into this analogy. But the, because of these names cropping up, you know, some of the anthropologists believe that there were different clans. But they weren't. They were just second and sometimes third names for the same clan. And there are 10 clans. And I was told that there are 10 clans because the clans are from the mother. We are matrilineal. We were born into the clan of our mother. And because of this, you know,